Kia ora and welcome to this episode of Better Off Read. My name's Pip Adam and in this episode I speak with poet Bill Nelson. Bill and I got together for a conversation on the occasion, I always start rhyming when we've got poetry on. Anyway, never mind. It's the occasion of the publication, of Bill's debut book of poetry called Memorandum of Understanding, which is published by Victoria University Press. It's a magnificent book. Gosh, it's so good. I enjoyed it so much. So Bill and I got together and we thought that what we might do is instead of discussing a collection of poetry, we'd discuss two poems. So today we discuss The Alchemy of Snow, which is by Kieran P. Sharp from her book There's a Medical Name for This, which is also published by Victoria University Press. And we also talk about Bill's poem Russell, which appears in Memorandum of Understanding. Now, if you are listening to this before Thursday, April 14, 2016, and it's before 6 p.m. in the evening, and you are close to Southern Cross Garden Bar at Enable Smith Street in Wellington, you will be able to go to the launch of this book, which will be great. Kate Camp is launching it, and Bill will be there, and it'll just be a wonderful night. If not, don't worry, you can read Bill's book, because it's amazing. And you can listen to this podcast. That's the other thing you can do, I just realised. Anyway, thank you for listening. Have a good day. Okay, so here we are. Hello, Bill.
Hello.
How are you? It's weird, eh?
Yes.
It's kind of weird.
You just changed your tone all of a sudden.
Did I?
Yes, you did. Oh, now you're very professional.
Oh, yes, I've gone professional. It's very professional. Welcome. I was just saying, we were just sitting here chatting and then I pushed the record button and everything went odd. Anyway, I'm very grateful that you came. Thanks for coming, Bill. We're up at the IIML. We are borrowing an office up here. Thank you very much, IIML. And today we are going to have a slight change of pace, a slight change of format, where instead of looking at books, we are going to look at one poem by an author who isn't you. That's right, isn't it?
Yep.
You're not Kieran P. Sharp.
No, not
good.
Yet.
That's good. Not yet. and one poem by you from your new book, Memorandum of Understanding.
Yes.
Which comes out in 2 weeks' time. Is that right?
Oh, just over a week now.
Next Thursday. Oh my goodness, next Thursday.
Yep.
Rush out. That's really cool. So, Bill, you chose a poem for us. You chose a poem from Kieran P. Sharp's book, There's a Medical Name for This, and a book called The Alchemy of Snow. And I was just wondering, I was thinking how I always like Kieran's poetry. Like, I always like it. And then I was trying to think of a way to generalize about it, and I couldn't really think of a way to generalize about it.
Yep.
And I wonder what attracts you to her work?
That's interesting, because I'm not 100% sure, because a lot of her work is quite mysterious.
Mm.
So you spend a lot of time thinking, like, what is she referring to here and what's going on? So it's hard to actually pinpoint something that does attract you from that point of view. And I think it's the thing where you're like lost in this mystery of most of her poems, and you're kind of going through it, and then suddenly there'll be one line that just like hits home, and it kind of all that confusion or whatever just kind of disappears. And I think it's that I really love, that it's you're never at any point following like the progression through the poem that's really predictable. It's just unpredictable all the time, and when something really hits home, it makes it so much more powerful. So yeah, I think that's what it is. Well, she seems to do quite a lot. I mean, not all the time, obviously. Like you say, you can't really generalise, but she does that quite a lot. And this particular poem, it was actually in Best New Zealand Poems, which I found out afterwards after I go, we should do that one. So yeah, someone else liked it
too. Yeah, we're awesome.
And Ian Weddy edited that one. He called it like a anti-essay, and like these kind of like little haikus that don't really, sort of a half-formed or something, you sort of go off the tracks a little bit. That's how he kind of described it, which is probably quite a good description. That then sort of the little snippets of ideas, not the whole picture sort of thing.
Because that's what I was thinking, like reading your book and reading this and thinking about poetry, and I was thinking how that's what I so love about poetry, is that it seems to work a different part of my body or brain, you know what I mean? Like it seems to I was listening to someone last night who was saying that maybe it works on a limbic level, you know, like, which I don't really, I think that means like kind of visceral, kind of right. Like, you know, like babies are limbic, they're just all like senses come in and, you know.
Does it mean like your limbs?
I don't know. I wish it did. I don't know what that word means. Limbic sounds like gymnastics. Yeah. I don't know. But I was thinking about how, like what you were just saying then, like there's that wonderful thing with poetry where understanding can often take a second place, can't it?
Yeah, well, I think it was understanding is probably the wrong word, but like the way you access the language isn't necessarily through like a narrative or the meaning of the obvious meaning of the words. It's like often working on just a pure sound level or something, which, yeah, a lot of my favourite poets do that, where it's, yeah, you can't really pick out exactly what's happening. It's just... So it just kind of washes over you and somehow has some kind of effect, overall effect, I suppose.
And did you come to poetry through music? Or was music the first...
I wanted to be a short story writer and a script writer.
I did not know this about you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Because they're like, you know, that's like the glamorous side of things.
Oh, my God.
So it's like, yeah, I'll be a script writer and make lots of money in Hollywood. That was my plan.
Yeah.
And I gave that a decent go, but... I did a course with Hini Moana Baker like almost 10 years ago now, and she kind of like just blew me away with her enthusiasm for poetry. And I'd always written a little bit of poetry but never really thought about it as anything more than just a confessional spouting your feelings on a page sort of thing. And I thought, oh, actually this is quite fun, and there's all these other aspects to it I'd never thought of, and all these poets out there I'd never read, like... she like got us to listen to Tom Waits and all these really, which I guess is music in a way, but he does a lot of kind of spoken word stuff, and all these poets I'd never even heard of, I didn't even know existed, and I was like, wow, this is really cool. And it just seemed to fit my way of writing a little bit more, I think, so it came a little bit more natural to me in the end.
Because that's, I was interesting reading again today, because I keep forgetting that Kieran P. Sharp did the course in, I can't remember what it was called, the Paper and Original Composition.
Yeah.
I think it was 1976, like it was a while ago.
Wow.
And then didn't write anything, didn't, you know, like the books are quite current, like quite recent developments, aren't they?
Right, I did hear that it took her quite a long time to get her first book out, but I'm not sure, if those poems are quite recent or whether they're sort of over that time or not, but... her first book is really interesting because it's got a lot of really short poems with really short lines, and it's kind of like maybe she just spent all those years working on like every single word in that line, because they're really, really dense, and particularly her first book is like seems really, really crafted, you know.
So, yeah
it's interesting that it could take that long.
But I think that's one of the joys in a way of poetry, isn't it, is that it is something that can kind of, it seems like it can happen a little bit more in secret and doesn't need sort of a book around it to make it, what am I trying to say? You know, like we do poetry readings, poems can be published in literary journals, sometimes they're published online. I just got a whole bunch, Emma Barnes has just done these poetry posters and stuff like that. Often they can kind of appear, you know, separately, can't they?
Yeah, I guess they're shorter, generally, which is good. Yeah. Like, they're good for podcasts.
Yeah, they're good for podcasts.
Yeah, it's interesting because they do, there's always people who've got, people who have ideas of, oh, we should put poems on posters or on the side of a bus or something. Because, yeah, they you can do that. Or, you know, on the writer's walk around Wellington.
Yeah.
They do lend themselves to all those things. But for me, those never seem like they're true form either, you know. The writer's obviously written it for a particular thing, which is usually the page or to be performed. That seems to be the two. I mean, I don't know anyone who writes poems designed to be put on posters. I don't know, maybe there are people who do that.
Maybe. Yeah. That's awesome. Shall we read this poem?
Yeah, cool.
So, do you mind reading it? Because you're the poet.
Oh, I thought you were going to read it.
Oh, no, you read it. Oh my God, that'd be so bad. I just never know how to read line breaks. What do you do with them line breaks where it stops?
Sometimes it's like a pause, you know? Sometimes... it's just, I guess it changes the meaning slightly, so you might have a slightly different tone for that line. Maybe it makes it more of a joke than it would otherwise be, so you might ham it up. Not that I can read like that particularly, but
I'm always jealous of you poets because you've got that line break thing.
You're
clever, because sometimes it means two things.
Yeah,
like you end it and you're like, oh yeah, and then it's awesome. Anyway, I won't interrupt you anymore. Would you please read us this poem?
Sure. So it's called The Alchemy of Snow. I should say as well, it's like lots of little sections, and there's these asterisks in between, which you won't be able to hear, obviously. But the interesting thing about them is they're giant asterisks, which always kind of makes you think, oh, like, what is they? Are they snowflakes? You know, that's kind of funny.
They're all the same too. Snowflakes are not supposed to be the same.
Yeah, that's true.
Oh, deep.
Maybe there wasn't a key for that on the keyboard. The snowflake key.
Snowflake key.
Yeah. Okay. The Alchemy of Snow. Snow is often found at the biology bar, in the company of potash and potassium. Her different melting points make relationships difficult. She can be driven. She has many names: Cyril, Tim, Bunny, Poppy, and so on. They form the scaffolding of her memory. She is the fortunate symbol of news from abroad and appears in teacups. The Edmonds Book, 1955, published her recipes: coconut ice, vanilla snow pudding, and melting moments. Using the Le Chatelier's principle, she reverses herself. There is this fruity smell. Late at night, farmers often hear her playing the accordion while she treats psoriasis in their horses. She is energy favourable. For the painting A Dutch Funeral, snow slid a simple pine coffin over frozen fields and under the smock mill's criss-cross sails and rickety gallery. She decorated the black veils of mourners and comforted a small dog. She is utterly faithful to the blackbird.
Awesome.
So great.
It's so great, isn't it?
I love the last bit. When it brings in the whole, like, Wallace Stevens 13 ways of looking at a blackbird thing.
Because it wears that quite openly on its sleeve, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
How many sections are there? 1, 2, 3.
There's only 10, I think.
Oh, there's 10, not 13.
Yeah. So yeah, that's different. And other than the snow and the blackbird mentioned right at the end, it's not really going too far down that road. I think, although the way she's written the actual sections are kind of similar, that they have these kind of, yeah, the Stevens poem is quite mysterious as well, and what it's sort of trying to say about the blackbird, I suppose.
Mm.
And it's sort of all the little things add up to something greater than what they are individually, which is something she tries to do as well, I think.
Because that's what I was thinking when I was reading it last night, and maybe even Russell to a point as well, your poem that we're going to look at. I was thinking that's often something poetry can do, isn't it? Like, it can take something and completely transform it by describing the things that it's not, the things that, you know, seem kind of riddle-ish, you know. Like, I was thinking about the riddle. I wonder who was talking about that. It might have been Nick Ascroft the other day, but this idea that it's sort of like a word picture, you know. And I was just thinking, poetry is often doing that, isn't it? It's trying to get through the normal language for something to try and see it in a different way, maybe.
Yeah.
Like, the other thing I really noticed is in the longer stanza, the one about the painting, I hadn't heard it because I'd read it on the page without reading it out loud, which is not a good thing to do with poetry, I don't think. But when you read it, I totally heard, like, rickety crisscross. You know, like, there's a lot of kind of, it's quite sonic in there where the rest of the poem isn't, eh?
Yeah, that one is quite interesting because it's quite different and it's a lot longer and has a lot more adjectives and things in it. Like, it's just going into full description about this painting. So yeah, that is interesting why she chose to do that. And I actually looked up, that is an actual painting called A Dutch Funeral.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in the Christchurch Gallery, so I presume she went and saw it because she's from Christchurch. And I found a little picture of it, and I was looking at it, and it's really interesting because, like, she pretty much describes this the scene that's in the painting. But then the bit where she says, and comforted by a small dog. You're like, I didn't have a high resolution picture, but I couldn't see a dog anywhere. And I was like, oh, she just totally made that up. Which again makes you think like, oh, what's going on with this whole like scene, you know? It's really interesting that it just sticks out like that. And I suspect maybe it's just because she decided she needed a longer piece with a different pace or something.
Mm.
And a bit more kind of sonic stuff going on. But
and it's interesting, it's cool as well, because it's sort of, it doesn't sit in the middle. Do you know what I mean? Like my sort of intuitive way of putting a piece like that, a flourish like that, would be to put it in the middle so that it sort of reaches some kind of climax. But instead, it's sort of the second to last line, the second to last stanza, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. I think it's kind of builds up to that last stanza, which has only got 7 words in it. So it's like this kind of little, it's not a rant, but it's got builds up its own little rhythm in that section, and then suddenly that stops and you get this 7 word, 2 line stanza at the end, which I guess gives it that much more power, that it's, you're just going from something long to something really short. Maybe that's part of it too.
And that use of the word utterly, man, there's something about that I don't even,
it's so, it's so emphatic, eh? It's like she's just so confident about that phrase, which I think is great.
It's just so good. And I'm, of course, you've got a question mark where I've got a question mark, still in this stanza. She is energy favourable. Like, yeah. I like how that sort of harks back to the idea of biology, doesn't it? Well, I just figured energy favourable was a scientific term.
Well, I tried to find out what it means and I couldn't find anything. So maybe it's a made-up scientific term.
Yeah.
Which is even kind of cooler in a way. Because there is a few other sciencey things in here, like Le Chatelier's principle, which I think is a real thing. And then there's stuff about biology and potash and potassium.
What's potash and potassium?
Potassium's like a...
It's sort of an element.
Element, yeah. I think potash is like the stuff that you use for... Isn't that what you put in your garden or something? I don't know.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, so there's like sciencey language through here, but the energy favourable, it's kind of... I couldn't find out what that actually means, but...
Yeah, when I read through it, it's made perfect sense at some... You know what I mean? Yeah. It's that thing where it seems to like get past logic and hit something out. I'm like, oh yeah, it's energy favourable. Yeah, of course. Of course, yeah, it's energy favourable. Right. Yeah, that's quite wild.
Yeah.
That's quite wicked.
Yeah, you don't really need to know, or you shouldn't need to know, I think, what, you know, you shouldn't have to have a science degree to like read a poem, I reckon. So you should, it should be able to access it on just the initial reading level. And then, but it is cool, like with this one, I went and looked up a few things and there was some interesting things going on behind it, which you find out later, which I guess is the sign of a really great poem, I think.
Because I guess it's also that thing, I mean, I don't even know if we're allowed to talk about this anymore, but it's kind of that postmodern thing as well, isn't it? You know, like, it wears its influence on its sleeve, you know, it's not afraid to say, yes, you will recognise this approach from, you know, Wallace Stevens' 13 Ways of Looking at Blackbird, and then it sort of seems to say, I'm going to throw these things in because... You may not know specifically what they are, but you might recognise, like when you see Le Chatelier's principle, you think, oh yes, like that language comes from this place.
Yeah.
So therefore it's like this. And yeah, I don't know, it's kind of interesting like that, eh?
Yeah, and I think it definitely leaves you with more questions than answers, which is always a good sign, I reckon.
I love that. And for me, that thing you were talking about where that line that lands, for me it was that single line stanza, she can be driven.
Yeah.
Like it just... Oh my goodness, there was something about that just hit me.
Yeah, that's one of my favourites too. I think it's because it's like, it's got the cliche of like driven snow, obviously. But then it's got this thing of driven as in like, and it's got the she becomes really prominent at that point. I think she's mentioned in the previous stanza, but obviously it's like, are we talking about a person now, not snow? And it's like, she can be driven as in she can be, you know, she can propel herself, or she can be driven as someone else drives her around, which is like, you know, opposite meanings in a way, which is like what's great about that word driven. It's like a cliche and then has two opposite meanings at the same time. It's like, I think that's why it works as a four word stanza, as it's got all that in it. And then who was the she as well, which is, just opens it all up really.
Yeah, because that's, I instantly thought, you know, the snow is the she. But then, like you say, when I came to that point, I had, just this overload of images, which is so weird because it's almost like the space that she gives makes for more images or something, eh? Like, because I was imagining a woman in a car being driven through the snow, then I was imagining the snow driving at a house, and then I was imagining, there was just so much in there. It's so clever.
Yeah.
See, poetry can do that. I'm not sure much else can do that.
Yeah.
I don't know, maybe an abstract painting? I don't know. Who knows? What else about it? Tell me some more about it.
So in the Best New Zealand Poems thing, she did write a couple of sentences about where the poem came from.
Oh, cool.
She actually said it started out as a short story, which is kind of interesting because it's about as far away from a short story as you get now. So I'd love to read the original short story. And she said it was about her friend's mother, which, like, maybe it's a bit cheating knowing that because it suddenly brings in all the stuff. Other stuff, like, is the she, her friend's mother? And the stuff about, there's bits in it that seem more about, more person-like than snow-like. Like, mm-hmm. There's the stuff about the names. Like, she has four names, and they're quite human names. And then the bit where she's playing the accordion and treating horses, like, that's not something you'd typically think Snow could do. So you're like, oh, suddenly maybe this is about this person. Maybe her nickname was Snow or something. It's maybe that's actually what it's about.
Mm.
So that was kind of interesting, actually, to find out that little tidbit of information.
And there's no help in the title. Like, that's something I noticed about her titles. All of them are lowercase, aren't they? So we're not helped out by, you know, the alchemy of capital S Snow, you know, like, what do you call it? Then it becomes a proper noun, doesn't it? But like, there's no help there, is there?
Yeah, no, I think if you hadn't gone and read the Best New Zealand Poems bio, it would just be, it's mainly Snow, really, that's in this poem. So,
that's the other thing I like about poetry is there's a degree of surrender. Like, it's like, okay, so you're saying that the snow is playing an accordion and fixing psoriasis and horses. Okay. Yeah. You know, like, there's something, you know, and then when I least enjoy poetry is when I'm like, oh, the accordion stands for, you know, horses stand for. Yeah, but it's wild.
Yeah.
That's really cool.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, you can push that too far as well, I guess, like, you know, You do have to have some kind of thread running through a poem, I think, which pulls people through it. And if you go too far away from that, it can actually be distracting. Like, you can do that in poetry as well. So it's a tough line to sort of walk the line of.
Because that's what I was wondering, you know, like, you were talking about writing short stories and film, and I was thinking, you know, like, film has quite a... You know, not all film, but film has a three-act structure, and this happens. You know, the way that they pull people through is rising action to a point of climax, and then, you know, it goes off. And in a poem like this, you've articulated it a bit, but can you articulate a bit more about what keeps a reader reading? Like, what is that thread that pulls the reader through, do you think?
Yeah, and I think that's tricky because every poem does it quite differently.
Yeah,
I think.
Yeah.
What
about this poem? What do you reckon?
I think, I mean, for this, it's like, I think the structure helps a little bit. Like, you're set up to expect something different with every section. So you're kind of waiting for that to happen. And then I guess you're sort of pulling snow through it, through a lot of the images that directly mention snow, or like you're trying to link it somehow to snow. It's a tricky one. I'm not 100% sure really about this one. I guess it's like that surprise. Is there a surprise element in this too? You know the next stanza. By the time you get to the third one, the weird names of snow, you know you're going to get something really strange in the next stanza. So I think that's maybe what it is. Like, I think I quite often enjoy poetry that that does have that element of surprise almost on every line. You know, you don't know what's going to come next, sort of thing.
Yeah. And I was thinking, for me as well, there's different kind of, I don't know what the word is, but it makes different noise in different places as well. You know, like, I was thinking, you know, like, music has that thing, yeah, like, you know, like, slam your hit with a, you know, with a four-word stanza, and then you've got a big, you know, like, you've got one that is slightly more adjective-based and more descriptive there, and then you've got, suddenly there are horses there, and... Yeah, I think, I was just thinking, I reckon you're right. I think that's exactly it, because I couldn't quite articulate it. And at first I thought it was me trying to make sense, but I don't think that's what it was about for me. I think you're right. I think it's closer to the fact that I was looking forward to the next surprise. Like, I was looking forward to being sort of swung in a different direction with it.
Yeah.
It's quite wicked.
Yeah.
What else about it? Is there anything else?
There's lots else.
There is, though.
I have scribbled all over my book now, as you can see, which is interesting because I never do that. Like,
don't you?
This has been really fun, actually, to be like, think about it really closely. Like, we're talking talking about this the other day, that often you just read a poem and mine it for a few good choice bits and then move on.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same with reading anything, really. It's very rare that these days that I get to sit down and think about it line by line, stanza by stanza. So, yeah. I'm not sure. I think we've pretty much covered a lot of what it's doing, I think.
Because I was thinking about that as well. Like, I started writing poetry. I'm the anti Bill Nelson by the sounds of things. I started writing poetry, and I don't know why, but I moved on to prose. I think what it was about was a frustration. I think it's that thing you're saying, how sometimes I couldn't make it sing in the way I wanted to. You know, there's something about the length of my breath or the way my mind works or something that prose seems to fit me better in some ways. But I used to love that about poetry. I can remember one of my most favourite days was, I think I spent like 7 hours on one line, like just, you know, like flipping it around and changing it. And I just, and I was thinking that's what's so wonderful about poetry. Like, there are poems that I read that I've read probably for as long as I've read a novel, you know what I mean? Like, I've read a novel once through and gone, yeah, that was great. But yeah. Then with a poem, I think I've probably read it for as long, you know, like read it so many times that it equals 400 pages or 300 pages. And there is just that, it does seem to, because of the way that it works, it kind of means that you can read it and there's a shift in meaning sometimes, eh? Like,
yeah.
Different points of your life reading it, I suppose, as well, eh?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, yeah, you really do have to, I mean, most good poems, you have to read them more than once, really, to get the full effect out of them. But, yeah, I guess, I don't know, maybe, I guess a good novel is the same, I don't know. Maybe you should read it more than once.
Yeah, maybe I should.
I mean, because you do read prose quite fast, and then you can quite easily miss really good bits, I suspect.
It's really true, eh? Like, I wonder if I do have a poetry reading mind. You know, like if there's a, you know what I mean? Like, I wonder
prose
if
writing mind and a poetry reading mind. Oh, that's probably a really awesome combination.
I feel like Frankenstein. Like Frankenstein. Right, let's get on to your book. Oh my goodness, I'm so excited. So this is Memorandum of Understanding, and it's going to be launched a week this Thursday. What date is that?
14th.
14th of April. That sounds like a good date to launch a book.
Yeah.
It just seems...
Yeah. Good number.
Fortuitous. Yeah. 14. Yeah. So can you tell me a little bit about how this book came about?
It came about over like 6 years.
Excellent.
So it came about very slowly. And it's really like there's some of the poems in there are that old.
Fantastic.
Not that many, to be honest. And then but most of them probably 2 or 3 years old. There was one point, I think, probably 3 years ago when I started kind of thinking about a form actually that fits, like we're talking about, like your mind either, you know, is maybe more suited towards poetry or prose or whatever you're writing or something in between. And I was trying to find forms that I thought fitted the way that some of my poems work, sort of on a cognitive level. And I started like doing this thing with like, you know, prose poems, but that are quite sort of shattered and broken up.
Mm.
Not the one I'm going to read today, but
this
weirdly,
is,
but it's basically like prose, but it's got little slashes in it, which break things up. And I think that really started a bit of a direction for me. I was like, oh, this is kind of interesting. And I felt like I'd found my form, which I hadn't really done before. I'd kind of just stuck to standard 3-line stanzas or, you know, something that you see often. So I felt like I found something unique to me, which was good, I think, to help bring the book together, tie it together a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I guess that's how it's come together a little bit.
So can I ask, I want to get back to these poems. Do you have a name for this yet?
For the form?
Yeah.
No,
I like fractured prose, but I like that.
Yeah.
I like that, because they do feel quite shattered.
Yeah.
Can I just stick for a little bit longer? So what's that process like? Like when I... Like, the closest thing I can get it to is, like, a collection of short stories where they start to build and all of a sudden they're feeding off each other in a way that makes me think, oh, this is one thing.
Mm.
And then I don't think I would say to myself, oh, I need a story about X and write it.
Yeah.
But I guess with poetry it's slightly different, isn't it? Because, like, did you think... there are pieces missing and I need something in this to fill the gap, or can you talk a little bit about
that? Yeah, I kind of tried not to do that, I think, yeah. Because I felt like if I did write a poem to fill a gap, it wouldn't be worthy, you know, like it shouldn't be filling a gap, it should be making another gap or something. So
nice.
You know, you could always be adding more, but I think it's at some point, someone said to me a while ago, you know, a book is just that point in time. These are the best stuff you've got, which I think in a lot of ways is true of this book. It's you know, it doesn't have an overarching narrative that I've deliberately tried to put in there.
Mm.
They are all, I try to write poems that work on their own,
mm.
don't need to be put in a book to work, sort of thing.
Mm.
So yeah, I quite like books like that where you can just go into it and read one poem and go, that was freaking awesome, and put it down. You know, you don't have to go, oh, I have to read the next 10 poems to make to put it into context.
So does a book seem like the right form for these? It does to me.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Because I was just thinking that, and I like, there's something so wonderful about how everything starts talking to each other in here as well. You kind of like I was just thinking, like the series. I particularly like this one, How to Do Just About Anything. That sort of slightly longer poem,
mm.
like that starts to talk to me, to the Starbuck Island stuff, and then, you know, like there's poems in here that sort of are about history. It feels touched by geology. There definitely seems to, it feels like a whole, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. And I think that happens subconsciously, you know.
Yeah.
Like if I try to consciously go, I'm going to write some stuff about geology and chuck it in here, it'll just be terrible. So you know, I have like my own preoccupations which just come out. Like this, I think when I was going through and putting the book together, I was like, oh, there's a few things in here that mention, I think the word Pacific is mentioned a few times, and I'm like, you know, I mean, my dad lives in Rarotonga, so I have this Pacific thing that occasionally comes up in poems, but I'd never think to make that an overarching thing, but it just comes out, you know. And I guess that's the, if you leave your poems open to, you know, not closing down the meaning of a poem, then that, you know, opens it up to those kind of things too.
Yeah.
And you can make links between them as well.
I remember Andrew Johnston came to talk to our class when I was doing the MA, and he was talking about his book of poetry, Sun, and he was saying that he reckons your obsessions start to order the work. You know, and I think that's so true for me, is that, you know, like I think they're subconscious things, like I do, and I keep trying to, you know, trying not to, you know, go where I'm, but I just end up going where I'm most interested, I think.
Yeah.
You know, and thinking, oh yeah, and then things do bubble up. So getting back to these poems, these fractured prose poems, I don't know what we're going to call them, they were a revelation to me. I've known you for a long time, and I feel like an idiot that I haven't realised that these were bubbling away. They're just magnificent. And I was really excited by the fact that these... Is this called a slash? This thing that...
I never know which is the forward and which is the backward one. I can never figure that out. But yeah, but they're slashes.
You use both.
Yeah.
Is there a different way of reading them?
Yeah, well, I kind of think of them as like... line breaks and stanza breaks.
Mm. Oh, I see. Yeah.
But actually, that's not really what makes me put them in there, because I think that's a bit obvious. what I actually like about it after I started doing it was that with a lot of them, it ends up you get like the slashes going both ways, and it really does look like someone's come with a little tiny knife and made little cuts in it, and kind of ran. It looks almost sort of like a random sort of pattern. Which I think is what I actually like about it. It's not anything to do with, yeah, it's a visual thing, but it's also, the fractured thing, and then maybe how you read it as well, pauses, I guess, or varying lengths.
Because for me, it was very, you know, like when you got one forward and one back, it also looked like kind of arms holding things, and, you know, like I got all this, it was really weird how much subconscious, my brain's busy, but when I was reading them, I was just enjoying, and I wasn't trying to work out the pattern or... You know, it was really interesting because the forward ones kind of made me lean in, and some of them made me lean back, and, you know, like, it felt really it was a very different experience from reading line breaks or reading prose poetry or reading almost anything that I've read before, you know, because it just, like you say, like, I'm just looking at How to Change the Oil in a 1979 Ford Escort, which is one of them. And yeah, it just looks like this wonderful kind of, you know, you can find paths through the slashes if you look at them from back here. And yeah, they're just fantastic.
Yeah, it's a little bit like a snakes and ladders board as well. You could kind of go up and down or something, I don't know. And the poetry does sometimes work visually too, which is on the page anyway, obviously. But yeah, that's an interesting thing that you can put a pull into it.
Yeah, I totally agree. Right, shall we read Russell?
Russell, yeah.
Okay, anytime you're ready. I won't interrupt.
Okay, I'll just find it.
It's on page 12. Oh,
thank you. Thank you for that. Okay. Russell. Russell is a ponytailed man, bearded, grey, jacketed in leather, a Harley parked in the drive. Russell is the sound of paper, miners scratching in the dirt, bullet holes in a church. A Pahutukawa reaches down and hugs Russell, who doesn't want to be hugged. Russell was once known as Old Blue, as in sweet, penguin-like, amassing at night. This was before the red, the great ruddy Russell. And then it was romantic, heaving itself upon the shore. And now it's sleepy, in the same way old men become sleepy, listening to late night radio. The moderator and the host, welcome to Russell, says Russell.
Awesome. I'm so glad you chose this poem. This is one of my favourite poems in the book. Can you talk about why you chose it a little bit?
I think it's quite good to hear as opposed to, you know, as well as read on the page. Some of the, you know, it's maybe has a bit more of a easy to listen to structure than some of the other poems I've written. Like, for example, the ones that are cut up with slashes. Yeah.
That's going to make interesting readings.
Yeah, that's right. Well, hopefully they work, read as well. But some things I find are easier to follow when you're hearing them for the first time than others.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's like I just love the word Russell, basically, as you can tell. So but, that's why I had to say it over and over.
And I think it's got, I mean, it does have echoes of the Kieran P. Chapp one as well that we just read, doesn't it? Like it sort of revisits an object, you know, and then the object changes to a sound and, you know, it's a person and then it's this and then it's that. It kind of echoes a little bit, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But then completely, look what you did at the end.
Yeah.
So it does sound like Russell is a great sound, and then there's some sort of there's a half rhyme with a penguin like amassing at night, dirt, church, oh my goodness, you sneaky bugger, I didn't notice that. then, you know, hugs Russell who doesn't want to be hugged, you know, ug, you know, all those wonderful vowely sounds, like it's really, really great. And a ponytailed man, bearded, grey, jacketed in leather, it's so great. Can you, do you hear... What does a first draft of a poem like this look like?
That's a good question. A poem, yeah, I mean, sometimes it's not that different from the final version, as in, like, it'll have the same number of stanzas and be broadly the same, but I'll end up just changing words or swapping the lines around or changing the syntax, I seem to do quite often. But other times I'll write a whole poem, throw away all of it except for, like, two stanzas or something and put that at the end or start again or something like that. I think this one here, maybe probably three quarters of it hasn't, the first three quarters was sort of didn't change too much, and I think I rewrote the ending probably like 1,000 times or something, which is also something that happens a lot.
You do bonza endings. Just over on page 10, the Battersea Bridge poem, like, holy crap. I mean, I was reading that and like, oh, yes, yes, yes. And then that last stanza just puts a knife in and squeaks you around. Like, yeah, that is something that I think's awesome in your poetry, is that it can turn itself completely around. It turns itself on a die, and then you want to go back and sort of think, God, was I... You know, you almost feel like you're a different person by the end, and you want to go back and check that you didn't misread the top or something.
That sounds good.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a good effect.
Oh, yeah, yeah, well done. I like that. No, I like that. Can you talk a little bit about the it that arrives? So is it Russell? You know how it sort of goes around? This was before the red, the great ruddy Russell, and then it was romantic, and now it's sleeping. Can you talk a little bit about the it?
What that, yeah, well, like, I think except for the Russell was a ponytailed man, I don't think I'd like gender Russell at all.
No.
Until that point, so it just seemed natural that it was Russell still an it at that point. But yeah, I guess reading back over it later, it kind of does stick out a little. Is it like it removed you a little bit from Russell? Mm. Suddenly Russell doesn't have a name anymore. It's just it, and it's romantic.
I loved the way it did that, because it sort of, especially like this idea that the first thing we learn about it is that it's romantic, you know, like, and it just, I don't know, like, I just really loved that, because like you say, it was kind of, it sort of brought the capital R Russell into kind of sharp focus as well, like, yeah. There was something so clever about it. I just thought it worked really well, and that wonderful thing at the end, like the idea of the moderator and the host, and I was thinking about that subject object kind of thing as well. That's really great. That's really, really great.
Yeah, it's interesting, because I spent quite a lot of time in Russell as a kid, and yes, I always knew it had, like, it goes through these every 5 years, they change like the slogan to describe Russell, like romantic Russell, or, you know, they're trying to get tourists to go there. And it seems like that's happened over its entire history, like it's just had this changing, like, persona, which is not really related to the place at all. It's just like a marketing term for, like, you know how lots of people call it, that was called the hellhole of the Pacific. And that just seems like almost like, I'm not a history buff, but it seems like that could almost be like a manufactured image of Russell or something. Like, maybe it was this really peaceful place most of the time, but it's been labeled the hellhole of the Pacific, and then it ended up being romantic Russell. It's like this weird, and it's had a whole bunch of other names too, which I kind of found out through doing a little bit of research. I was like, oh, that's really cool to, like, how many different things can Russell be?
Because it is, like, I know when I think about Russell, like, I grew up in Auckland, and I think we went to Waitangi a couple of times, and we would go to Cape Reinga, and, you know, like, it was kind of like this, but the terms of that trip were always about colonization in a way, you know. It was kind of like, oh, this is the birth of the nation, and, you know, like, it's a real, it's quite, it, and it always seems like quite a, you know, in the stone store and stuff like that, it was always sort of this weird, problematic place for me. And I think, I don't know, I just think it's so awesome how a lot of this book does feel like it captures a little bit of the problematic nature of the Pacific, you know, and doesn't sort of shy away from it. You know, like, you've got this series, The Pigeon History of New Zealand, where you've got an erasure poem, and then, you know, poems called Settlement and Unsettlement and Post History, and where does that come from?
That kind of started, I just read Michael King's Penguin History of New Zealand, and it was, like, really informative, obviously. But what I really loved about it is it reads kind of like a novel. Like, his language, the way he wrote it, is just brilliant. And I just loved, I love the way that he, I guess, brought, like, kind of vivid language to history. So I was kind of like, I was just playing around with, I just used the headings of some of his chapters or sections or whatever they were, and just thought, oh, how could I play with language and history in a way that kind of, I think, honours, like, that book. Like, in poetry, I guess, like, it's a completely different thing. And I guess I didn't want it to become, you know, a factual retelling of history, because it's more of just a made-up history of something. But, yeah, and then his politics, I think, kind of come into that book a little bit as well. Like, he's quite objective, obviously, but there's a hint of that sort of stuff in there. So I wanted some of the sections in that poem are, like, overtly political sort of thing, so I just wanted to play with that, really.
Yeah.
And then he actually appears in the very last section of it, I kind of just like, oh, I'm going to put Michael King into the poem.
So nice.
Yeah.
And like, that is a long way. You know, we started off talking about, like, confessional poetry.
Yeah.
That's a long way from, you know, the poetry. I found some of my poetry from high school the other day, and it was just, you know, they don't like me, why don't they like me? You know, And I'm just wondering, you know, can you talk a little bit about that? You know, like, putting poetry to this use, when perhaps the mainstream idea of poetry might be a less sort of, I don't know what the word is, a more personal kind of, you know, confessional sort of use.
Yeah. Well, they're both great ways to start writing a poem, I think. I mean, so much great poetry comes just from that kind of emotional well, I suppose, which teenagers tap into pretty easily. Like, I think I had a series of poems called, like, Winter 1 and Winter 2 and stuff. It was just like horrible, like me being depressed as a teenager in the middle of winter. But yeah, I guess I've, like, as I've gone on, I've just, like, I think I've got more into just, like, getting really excited by language. So I'll read something like The Penguin History of New Zealand and just get really wrapped up in the language of it, and that just fires off all these ideas and things that could come into poems. So I guess that's often a starting point for me, rather than, you know, I'm feeling a bit down today, what should I write about, sort of thing.
And, like, this celebrates language so much. Like, I'm just thinking, there is the instructional How to Change the Oil in a 1979 Ford Escort, you know, which sort of seems to, you know, borrow some of its language from interesting places. And then there is, like, Memorandum of Understanding, which, you know, just is just so heartbreaking in the way that you use sort of the language of, I don't know, I always think of it, because I've worked in public service, I always think of it as the language of corporate and public service speak. And, I mean, it seems like, and then, you know, I mean, we haven't even begun to talk about the Coltrane poem, but, like, you seem awake to language. You know, this does seem like a celebration of language in a way.
I really hope so.
I get super excited about it. And there's even like the series or poem at the end, How to Do Just About Anything, that comes from a book as well, doesn't
it? Yeah, like, pretty much all of the interesting words in there I've just ripped out of a really uninteresting book, which is called How to Do Just About Anything, which is like a DIY home improvement guide from the Reader's Digest in the 1980s. So I just, like, pulled all this great stuff out of there, like all these weird things that they decided to include in this book, and some of the kind of, it's like point in time a little bit as well, it's from the 80s, I think, so it has all this stuff in it that people don't do anymore.
Yeah.
And I just loved all the language of all that stuff, and I thought, oh, well, how can I just throw all this into a series of little poems, and then bring in this other stuff that's, yeah, it's got my a pseudo grandfather in it, bit of an imagined grandfather and all that kind of thing. So yeah, I always find when you combine some really interesting language with something else that's going on that you've been thinking about, or you just bring something else in and combine those things together, that's when really, really good stuff starts to happen.
I get so excited when you talk about, like, a pseudo grandfather and imagined grandfather, you know, because I think for years I just read every poem is autobiographical, you know, like, I was just like, ooh, you know, and I just love the fact that poetry can be put to this other use, you know, like, which I just think is so great.
Yeah.
Can I ask a slightly biographical question? You, is it wrong to say that you're a geologist?
Yes.
Okay.
I studied geology at university.
Yeah.
Up until stage 3. So I have, like, a distant recollection of a couple of words of geology, which is enough to, like, sound in a poem, sound like you know what you're talking about.
Yeah. I've become slightly obsessed with geology because your poem about geological time, like, I started getting very interested in geological time, and that was something in this book as well, is that it feels like there's different times kind of being fed in through the language as well, you know, like, there feels like there's, you know, because I feel like, in a way, that poem about How to Do Just About Everything does kind of capture that strange 1980s kind of, yeah, like, that language. And then, you know, we move into poems that are, you know, talk about Moby Dick and turtles and, you know, like, how does time operate in a poem? Like, that, if we look at that poem, Russell, like, is that a snatched moment in time? Is it, does it reach back into the past? Does it, you know, even, like, you even play with tense, don't you? Russell is a ponytailed man, but Russell was once, you know. Can you talk a little bit about how you imagine time operating in that poem?
Well, yeah, so obviously it's kind of like through the various names or slogans that Russell's had, it goes back through time.
Mm.
But I didn't decide to, you know, do to mark that with language or anything like that as well. I think that'd probably be a bit too over the top. So yeah, I think the actual, like, the subject matter of that poem has a time element that I kind of move through. Not particularly linearly, but that's where the time aspect of that poem is. But I think the language is all fairly kind of contemporary, I suppose, in the language I've chosen. Mm. Even like, so I'm going to pronounce it terribly, but kororeka, that means something like sweet blue penguin.
Mm.
And I thought about putting that word in there, but it's very loaded, obviously. Like, people automatically think hellhole of the Pacific sort of thing, where I didn't want that, so I was like, well, I'll just talk about these little penguins sort of thing. Which, yeah, brings it back again to probably that more contemporary sort of language, and I guess. Yeah, so I think probably that's how I would think time works in there, but I've also, I guess the way the poem moves through the ideas has a sort of a time aspect. So I think at the end, somewhere I'm trying to find the page 12, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, it says, and then it was romantic. So obviously that's putting itself after some of the other things. Mm. In the previous stanza says this was before, so... I have tried to kind of mark the time, which I think helps what's one of the threads you can have through a poem that pulls people through it. Like, that's like almost a prose, like, you know, and then this happened and before that this happened sort of thing. So, you know, same way prose, I guess, can pull you through a story with those kind of time markers.
Cause that's,
you can do that in a poem too.
Yeah, because that's what I was thinking is interesting, is often what's the word called? Chronology is used in like a piece of prose, isn't it? Like, you get this sense that there's a beginning and an end and you're moving towards it. Whereas I was just looking at Angel Wing on the other page, which is this, it's one of my favourite poems, because, you know, I know that Albany Expressway. And I think a lot about how it's changed over the years, you know, like, we used to drive up there and there was nothing there, and now, you know, it's like just a metropolis of suburbia sort of thing. And I really like in there the way the goats kind of sit simultaneously with the expressway. You know, the goats from the past sit simultaneously with the expressway. And poetry can do that a lot, can it? It's quite lithe. It's quite, I don't know what the word is, agile, to use a word from corporate speak. But, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you can. So, I mean, you do have to make those choices. Like, you can have the time markers in there, but you have to equally choose to, like, just take that stuff out and be like, I'm going to have something from the past and something from the present or the future, like, just sitting next to each other. And maybe that's what that poem has to do to achieve what it needs to do, sort of thing. So,
yeah.
I think more often I probably take those kind of time things out rather than put them in. I tend to prefer, like, just to mash things up, I suppose.
Yeah, that's the joy of it. It's a wonderful, I'm really falling in love with it again as we sit here flicking through it. So what do you have to do between now and Thursday? What does someone do when they have a new book between now and Thursday?
I don't know.
Do you have to make a speech or anything?
I think I'm supposed to read a poem. I don't know. I need to talk to whoever's organising it.
It's kind of exciting.
It's all coming together really well.
Yeah, it's all good. Yeah, it's all very organised. I'm very organised.
Now, Kate Camp is launching it, so she'll be awesome.
Oh, she's so great.
So she'll probably, like, give a long, impassioned speech, I'm sure.
How awesome you are.
Yeah,
it'll be very good.
I think so.
How does it feel to hold it? How did that feel?
Yeah, really weird. It feels like, and when I read from it now, it feels like I'm reading someone else's poems. It's like, I'm reading this poet, Bill Nelson, today.
He's got a book.
It's kind of what it feels like, because, you know, up until now I've just read off pieces of paper that I've printed on my computer, which feels like it's my thing because no one else has it. But it doesn't feel like that anymore, to be honest.
It's an interesting sort of what's the word, kind of exercise in letting go as well, eh?
Yeah.
Like, I guess when they were in those bits of paper, you decided who you handed those bits of paper to.
Yeah.
But now it's slightly different, I guess. It's slightly different.
Do I not get to decide who buys them?
Yes, no. Yes, you can sit there and go, not you. Sorry. No, no, not you, not you. So what do you do now? Do you take a break? Do poets take a break?
No, we work tirelessly
at the computer.
I submitted this to VUP well over a year ago, so
yeah.
I figured that's, and I knew they weren't going to publish it for a while because they had a full calendar basically,
yeah.
And I knew, so I thought, oh, I can't just do nothing for that long. So I've been working on some new stuff.
Awesome.
But, and patches, I suppose, so yeah.
And what does your writing week look like? Give yourself some time?
Yeah, I'm lucky enough to get Tuesday and Thursday mornings sort of off work.
Awesome.
So I can do some poetry before I go to work.
Yeah.
Which is pretty much the only time I get at the moment.
Yeah.
Which is really great because otherwise I need that kind of structure.
Me too.
The working day.
Well, thank you for coming here on your Tuesday morning.
Thank you.
I should be
writing some poems.
I know. It'll be like, what? I came and talked to her instead. Hey, thank you so much. And all the best for the launch. We'll look forward to it.
Yay.
Thank you.
Bye.